this is the longer version of Kate Russell's feature on internet freedoms from the IGF conference in Azerbaijan, from episode 163 of The Pod Delusion. So without further ado, let's hand over to Kate with more.
How much freedom do you really have? If you live in the West, the answer to that question is probably quite a lot, especially if you're connected to the internet. But this month I learned that the freedom to speak doesn't always lead to being free after you speak. When I met journalists and campaigners at the 7th Annual Internet Governance Forum, or IGF, held in Baku, Azerbaijan.
Internet may not be a human right, but it is fundamental to the exercise of human rights of expression and access to information and exchange. If someone takes the internet away from you, that is a violation of your human right of expression.
That was the voice of Vint Cerf, one of the co-founders of the internet and a bit of a rock star at these events. So I had to stalk him from the buffet queue for quite some time to record that comment. I'd known freedom of expression was going to be a key topic at this year's IGF, as Azerbaijan's human rights record had come under fire earlier in the year when the Eurovision Song Contest rolled into town. But I have to confess, I was caught a little off guard by how upfront and in-your-face criticisms of the host nation were. We were here to talk about internet governance in what is normally a painfully PC format. These people invented the term politically correct. But in Baku, local journalists, bloggers and human rights campaigners turned out in force to point the finger directly at the government, standing as eyewitnesses and even victims of crimes they accused the government of being implicit in, or at best, doing nothing to prevent. To get to grips with the issue that was clearly going to dominate this meeting, I'd arranged to attend a pre-event session on human rights organised by local pressure group Expression Online. The venue was huge, big enough to fit the plenary hall and several dozen other rooms for meetings and workshops incumbent to the IGF format in one half, and the country's biggest annual trade telecoms expo in the other. A constant cacophony of white noise flowed up into the high rafters, and you had to wear headphones hooked up to the sound system to hear anyone speaking more than a few metres away from you. The atmosphere was tense as the session room filled up. And when it eventually got underway, it became clear the tension wasn't going to ease, as a technical glitch meant that the Azeri translation had to be broadcast on the same channel everyone was listening to. The keynote speaker, OSCE Freedom of the Media representative Dunja Majitovic, made a valiant attempt at patience as each sentence was laboriously repeated in Azeri.
This is also something that I'm going to discuss with the officials during the IGF, because this can affect our lives, short-term, but not to mention the threat that exists long-term.
But the atmosphere was already tight following claims that local reporters and bloggers had been refused entry to the venue on the grounds they might protest. Pretty soon, Audio Channel 1 had devolved into a buzzing babble of voices talking over each other louder and louder. When the time came for the Q&A session, there was further tension as a pro-government speaker shouted angrily about being censored when he was asked to hurry along to his point so that others could have time on the microphone. Despite the chaotic session, I had a chance to speak with some of the contributors afterwards. Emin Huzhinov is a freedom campaigner and reporter who in 2008 ended up in intensive care after being severely beaten at a police station.
A general problem in Azerbaijan, we don't have freedom of expression right now because we have 10 imprisoned journalists. And after 1 year, we have presidential election. And when government organized total arrests from bloggers, representatives, journalists, representatives. After this arrested, media society start implement very big level from self-censorship.
One of the many shocking stories I heard that day was Khadija Ismailova's, an investigative reporter working for Radio Liberty, who spent much of the last few years investigating government corruption.
I hope this Internet Governance Forum will help Azerbaijanis and maybe other countries, other people as well, to learn who is providing internet there in their countries. Because lack of transparency is a huge problem in the internet world. We don't know who is owning the backbone providers in our country. In one case, I did an investigation and I found out that president's daughters, through their offshore companies in Panama, own the telecommunication company, and that telecommunication company owns one of the backbone providers. But another one, the biggest backbone provider, Delta Telecom, Ministry of Communication just doesn't answer the question who owns it.
Why is it important that we know who owns these infrastructures?
Well, because it's important because it should be diverse, and it shouldn't be under the ruler's control. It should be fair game for everyone, and it should be equal opportunities for everyone, and it shouldn't be. Corrupt officials should not have hand on the main mean of the internet. It means that the source of all internet in the country, it's very important. For many years, for four years, the 3G services, which is the fast internet on your mobile phone, were under monopoly of President's daughter's company. And only after the investigation I've done, where I found out that they are the owners, the government was lying to us, saying that Siemens is. When after the investigation, the government opened this opportunity to other telecommunication companies, so it became more accessible for the whole country. And the same should be with internet. If there will be diversity, if there will be fair competition in this market, then we will have cheaper, more accessible internet throughout the country. But right now, it's being controlled by two companies. The whole internet channel coming to the country is being controlled by two companies, and one of them is owned by president's daughters. Another one, we don't know who. There are rumors that that's a security chief of the presidential administration, but these are only rumors. I don't know.
Now, you're clearly a very vocal and important voice in journalism in this country. And as such, you've become kind of the subject of some of the issues that we've been talking today about freedom of expression and human rights. Can you give me sort of a top line of the kinds of difficulties people like you are dealing with in this country?
Well, it's investigative journalism proved to be a deadly profession in Azerbaijan, and being a critical government critique is not a safe thing in this country. In 2005, our colleague Elmar Huseynov was killed, and now his case is being filed with the case on government's non-action in solving its case, finding the perpetrators, assassins, and orderers, is being filed to European Court of Human Rights, and we are expecting them to consider that case. The same with other journalists. Like, none of the crimes against journalists, critics of the government, has been solved yet. Nobody has been punished for that. So this creates an impunity condition for them, and there is an open season for journalists in this country. There was other thing that happened, like other means, how they, like, there are constant beatings, kidnappings, arrests of journalists, but also there is a heinous way of silencing journalists practiced by the government of Azerbaijan, is the bugging the bedrooms. And bugging the bedrooms and then exposing the sexual life of the journalist. It happened in 2010, first time, when the commercial director of Azadlik newspaper, he was filmed secretly in his bed, in private apartment, arranged in sexual relations with women. And that video was shown on TV channel ran by president's cousin during primetime news, before children went to bed, at 7 o'clock news, and it was announced all day before it was shown. Actually, with the footage was accompanied by very nasty political text against opposition, and that video was shown, and then that guy disappeared. He quit his job. He disappeared, and well, we don't see him for many years now, like since 2010. And in 2011, another guy was filmed in a hotel room masturbating, and that was shown this on the same channel ran by President's cousin. It's officially ran by President's cousin, and. Well, after that, like, everyone was expecting something like this happened to him, and that happened to me as well. So it's they filmed my bedroom. Then I discovered that there were wires. I discovered wires in my bedroom, living room, and bathroom even. And even bathroom. And I was filmed with my boyfriend in my bedroom, engaged in sexual relations. And that was then I was blackmailed with that video. Well, I said openly that I'm not going to stop any of my investigations, and I'm going to continue my work. So then it was posted online, and there was a huge backfire on the government because of this, and that made the government to step back and say that they are condemning as well, and they will open the criminal case. But criminal case is being opened for 7 months now. Nothing happened. I'm still not sure that it happened. They did because they don't inform me about the investigation. So to all my letters, I received the same answers, like a criminal case is opened, and you will be informed. That's it. So it's very unfriendly environment, and it's very difficult to work here. Well,
but you keep going. Why do you keep going?
Well, because someone should do that, and I mean. I find it's not good enough reason to stop doing, because living with a feeling that you are scared to do what you want to do is even worse. So I don't want to feel scared. I want to do what I want. I don't want any other people to tell me what to do or what not to do. It's basic right. It's freedom. It's called freedom.
But despite the European courts doing their best to rein in heavy-handed officials, Mike Harris from Index on Censorship believes there are much deeper issues starting to get tangled up in this increasingly international performance.
It's clear the government of Azerbaijan are spending a lot of money on propaganda attempts to influence the West. So far this year they've spent $500 million on the Eurovision Song Contest, on the beautification of Baku, which often means demolishing buildings and forcing the residents out with no legal process, and this, the Internet Governance Forum. And this is an attempt to say to the outside world, this is a forward-looking country, come and invest here, you know, continue to buy our oil and gas. And the reality is that, you know, internet activists, the sort of internet activists you would have met yesterday, are harassed, beaten, and threatened on a pretty much continual basis. And the government will stand up, and its officials will stand up at meetings and say, well, look, we're being criticised at these sessions. Surely this is indicative of the fact that there's free speech in Azerbaijan. But, you know, it's a total nonsense. They're allowing a little bit of space for some of the activists to criticise the government here at the IGF, knowing that those activists, so Emin Milli, for example, who's been in prison for 2 years, Khadija, who you interviewed, who's been, you know, incriminating tape filmed in the privacy of her own home with secret cameras, was posted on the internet in an attempt to silence her investigations of corruption in Azerbaijan. Other bloggers that I've met, I met a blogger called Elna Majidi, who is based in Strasbourg, and I met him at the Council of Europe. He set up a Facebook group calling for protests on the streets while in Strasbourg. His family have been persecuted since. His father lost his job with the state oil company. They attempted to start a prosecution against him for treason, which carries a 20-year jail sentence. And this is for setting up a Facebook group. What the Azeri, the method the Azeri government use is anyone that's a tool poppy, anyone that puts their head above the parapet is shot down. So most internet users, most people posting comments on Facebook or on Twitter will not be censored. They won't have any, pretty much nothing will happen to them. It's the few, it's the most famous, it's the Emin Millies, it's the most active human rights defenders. Those are the ones they go after, and they put them in prison. And if they don't put them in prison, they threaten them. And if they don't threaten them, then family members lose their jobs. It's a pattern of intimidation. I would say this is a good opportunity for international human rights organisations to send a clear message to the government of Azerbaijan. The problem comes when Western politicians don't criticise the government. And we see it with a number of members of parliament from the UK who have been on all expenses paid trips to Azerbaijan, where they go to the nicest hotels and they meet pro-government ministers and their supporters. And there was a recent trip by conservative friends of Azerbaijan where they came here and they met with the head of SOCAR, which is the state oil and gas company. And this is the same man that covered up the beating of an independent journalist, a guy called Idrak Abbasov, who is a friend of Index on Censorship. He came to our awards, he won an award, we gave him an award for his really fearless journalism. And while he was filming the demolitions of people's houses in downtown Baku, a group of security officers came over and they beat the hell out of him. And he went into hospital. The photos from hospital are horrendous. You know, his face is covered in blood. His leg was broken, you know, really nasty stuff. And yet, weeks later, British MPs are having nice, you know, cordial chats with the head of the organisation whose security guards beat this guy up. So, I mean, that's the issue that the media can focus on. But until government ministers hear clear and loud from Western politicians that they need to improve, they do get away with it. And that's why I was heartened by European Union Commissioner Nelly Kroes' comment. She's been really strong on this, and that's fantastic. Expression Online's latest policy note, the IGF organisers refused to allow it to be distributed because apparently it contains criticisms of the government. I mean, this is a UN conference. This is not an Azeri government conference. So the idea that people shouldn't be allowed to freely criticise the government of the host, you know, the host government, is just absolutely ridiculous. But it's worth noting, Azerbaijan is a member of the Council of Europe. So it has to abide by the European Convention on Human Rights. And this has helped. This is, you know, its court judgments have got political prisoners out of jail. But at the same time, they are lobbying in Strasbourg to stop court rulings being implemented. So they're a member of a club, but they spend lots of time and lots of money on undermining the rules of the club. And we've got to be much tougher when this happens.
Now, yesterday, you weren't actually in the conference centre. You had another engagement. Do you want to tell me what that was about?
So I went, I was at the conference in the morning, and then I went in the afternoon after lunch to witness and monitor the trial of an independent journalist, Avaz Zeynali. He was the former editor of an independent newspaper. He was arrested a year ago, placed in prison while his trial was ongoing, and an MP has accused him of extortion, claiming that he wanted money, and if he didn't get the money, he'd write articles about this member of parliament. Now, this same member of parliament, there's a recent video has been posted online showing her selling parliamentary seats. So she's hardly the most, perhaps hardly the most honest of witnesses. And this is clear video footage of her asking for $1 million dollars for a parliamentary seat. Now, the journalist basically has always denied these allegations, and he's always denied these allegations. And yesterday he said in the court, the allegations that have been made against him are in a video clip. But all the court has been shown is a transcript of the video clip. So just a written transcript. The actual video has never been seen by him or his lawyers. And this is the key piece of evidence. So the piece of evidence that's going to potentially put him in prison for up to 7 years, he hasn't seen, and nor has his lawyer. I mean, it's just a total shambles. And the worst thing is, I went to this trial alongside a representative from Human Rights Watch and Article 19. We sat in this tiny little pokey court, really run down, and this poor journalist was in a steel cage in front of the judge. And it just, you know, the standard of justice over here is abysmal. There were his family, really upset. He's shouting in this cage, "I've been arrested, you know, I've been in jail for a year. You still haven't presented any evidence against me." The judge is telling him to be quiet. The chief prosecutor is, you know, shouting back, saying, "We're not showing, you know, we're not showing this evidence. The MP's going to come and testify, but not today. You'll have to wait." And this guy's newspaper's gone under because he can't operate. And it reminded me of the show trials that you sort of, you know, you witnessed in the Soviet Union. And this is happening in a country which is a signatory to the European Convention on Human Rights. And we're letting it happen.
For other observers, such tactics were not a surprise, like Courtney Radish, whose organisation Freedom House has just released an annual Freedom on the Net report, which analyses the state of internet freedom in 60 countries.
So what can listeners to this podcast?
Governments use several strategies, primarily six key strategies to attack online and digital freedoms. They're technological, legislative, offline intimidation and attacks, cyber assaults, content manipulation, and surveillance. And there's also a gender dynamic to these. So in terms of technological strategies, this includes blocking, phishing, malware attacks. And one of the most concerning aspects is that Western governments, including the UK and the US, or rather companies that are based in Western countries like the US and the UK, as well as China, are selling this software that enables technological attacks against cyber activists, as well as surveillance and monitoring. That's very problematic. We also see legislative attacks, and those include passing restrictive laws that prevent free expression or require registration of websites or social media platforms, or for bloggers to become part of an association, for example. And of course, the issue of intermediate liability, which is holding internet intermediaries like websites, web hosting services, ISPs, etc., responsible for the information that's flowing through their networks. We also see increased offline intimidation and attacks, which is where governments are attacking activists because of their online activities, but attacking them physically or arresting them, torturing them, and in some cases they've been killed. Obviously, Syria, we see this happening with citizen journalists. Authoritarian governments are increasingly aiming to control images and control the information that is getting out of their countries. The next strategy that they use are cyber assaults, and this is when they focus on attacking activists online. So this can happen through trolling attacks, through hashtag bombing, and this is essentially when they use online mechanisms such as creating fake Twitter accounts, which is called trolling, and attacking these cyber activists online, trying to discredit them, dishonor them, or defame them online. The next and last thing that I'd like to talk about is the content manipulation and surveillance, and that's when governments are creating pro-government messages online to try to win framing battles and set the agenda and to discredit activists online as well. So, for example, we see pro-government bloggers being paid 50 cents in China. They're called the 50 centers. In Iran, you have pro-government bloggers that are being paid to try to counteract the narrative that is out there. And there's a difference between those and, for example, what the U.S. State Department does, which is they do pay State Department employees to post comments, for example, but they're identified as such, and they are directed outward rather than inward at someone's, at the country's own population. And then just the last point is on gender, is women face a specific threat online and offline because many a times they're attacked and specifically some of the cyber assaults that happen online, try to defame and dishonor them, accuse them of being prostitutes or other sort of culturally relevant threats. And this can have real implications for their security and safety. So we see that governments are becoming increasingly sophisticated in the attacks that they're using, and that they are less blunt than they used to be. They're harder to see oftentimes. And this intensified censorship and violence against bloggers and online users has, I think, increased in the wake of the Arab uprisings, as authorities around the world have sought to quell public calls for reform.
One person who was fiercely critical of the situation in Azerbaijan was European Commissioner Nelly Kroes. Her office put the boot in quite publicly with several acerbic press releases during the event, and Kroes herself posted a couple of provocative tweets from outside the prison walls on Wednesday, the 7th of November. The first one says, "Waiting outside Azerbaijan prison hospital to see if they stick to my agreement with president to see prisoners," and she's posted a picture of her waiting. And then not long after, another tweet, "3 weeks of games, then head of presidential administration says, while at prison gates, that visit is not on. Openness in Azerbaijan." And last week, the feisty commissioner posted a scathing write-up on her official blog, which stated quite plainly, "I was denied access to meet political prisoners, despite a commitment from the president himself. Activists were harassed at the internet conference. My advisers had their computers hacked. So much for openness." So was it a total waste of time when it comes to freedom of expression at this year's IGF? Not according to Marcus Coomer from the Internet Society. As one of the founding fathers of the IGF, he was at the World Summit in Tunis when the idea was conceived in 2005.
It is fairly obvious that in the past few years, the issue of human rights, freedom of expression, has gained momentum. That was not least triggered off by the Arab Spring. People have become more aware how important this is, and also there were developments outside the IGF framework, such as the Human Rights Council of the United Nations has adopted a resolution clearly stating that what is valid offline should also be valid online, that is, human rights should be respected offline as online. And all in all, we quite often state that the Article 19 of the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights reads like a definition of the internet, that is, to guarantee free flow of information, access to knowledge, regardless of frontier, through any media. That was written well before the internet was invented. And regardless of frontiers, back in the early 1950s, wasn't that obvious? And this is what we see now, that many governments actually realize that the internet, which doesn't recognize any borders, actually undermines their authority of what happens within national borders. It is an underlying tension that really comes to the fore.
One of the interesting things about this year's event is, you know, where it's taking place. You know, in a country which, you know, on the world stage became quite clearly not the best record of human rights. And here we are talking about freedom and inclusion at the internet. Do you think that there's a strange juxtaposition here? What's your sort of stand on that?
Well, we have to accept that in the UN context, whoever offers to host a meeting will usually get the meeting they offer to host. We had the World Summit in Tunis, and the Tunis government at that time was rather authoritarian. But nevertheless, we went ahead with the meeting, and maybe the meeting also contributed to an opening up of the Tunisian society, and now we know there's a different government in place. We had an IGF in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, which was also held in a country at the time when there were bloggers in prison. And we went there because Egypt is an important member of the United Nations, and the United Nations accepted the generous offer. But whatever is said in the conference hall is held under UN auspices, and hopefully it carries the message also out into the country. I remember in Tunis when the Swiss president said freedom of expression has to be respected inside this hall and outside. And there was applause in the hall. Unfortunately, the Tunisian television then had a glitch and it was not broadcast outside the room. But nevertheless, I think we can with hindsight say the message was heard also outside the hall.
UK Minister for Culture, Communications and Creative Industries, Ed Vasey, was also out in Baku and echoed Kuma's feelings on the location.
Well, Azerbaijan is a strategic ally of the United Kingdom and we have a lot of investment here in oil and gas. BP has a large presence here, so a lot of British companies are based in Azerbaijan. But we don't shy away from challenging Azerbaijan on its human rights record and calling for it to improve. And I met with a group of bloggers and opposition politicians this afternoon in Baku to talk about their issues. So we reach out all the time to alternative voices in Azerbaijan as well as working with the government, and we make no secret of our concerns, and they listen to what our concerns are. I would say that you know, a country like Azerbaijan, you know, one should remember, was part of the Soviet bloc just 20 years ago, so it's on a journey, and it's important, I think, as well as raising concerns, it's also important to engage. I think bringing the Internet Governance Forum to Baku, bringing a whole range of different voices into Azerbaijan, can only be good for Azerbaijan and its future.
There were, of course, lots of other issues on the agenda in Baku, like regulation and infrastructure and the never-ending topic of copyright and IP. You can check out the transcripts on the IGF website, as long as you have a high threshold for bureaucracy and nothing else planned for a while. But the underlying current of every workshop and discussion I attended was freedom. It wasn't so much the elephant in the room as the big fat gorilla jumping around on the table. The last person I spoke to on the subject was Johan Hallenborg from the Swedish Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Providing a platform like this allows all stakeholders to come. And I think what the IGF has proven to me, at least, is that it's become more and more penetrated by human rights issues over the years. And that is something that we have actively been trying to promote. Our position is that it's very important that the IGF goes to countries and is arranged in places where the human rights record is less than perfect. There is no country with a perfect human rights record. So I think it's important to provide this meeting place where also local activists and local people can see and engage themselves in these important issues. So that's something we really, really welcome. We think that all decisions on internet policy, all discussions, should be done from a human rights perspective.
Since returning to the UK a little over a week ago, there have already been more reports of journalists targeted with police brutality in Baku, with two reporters severely beaten at a demonstration despite wearing vests that clearly identified them as media workers. I'll get James to link that story on the website too. I caught up with Mike Harris again briefly over a very bad Skype connection for his reaction.
There has been a police crackdown on opposition protests. On Saturday, around 30 demonstrators attempted to protest in the centre of Baku, and the government brought in a new law which is incredibly strict on political protest, and it's raised the fines for protesting in central Baku significantly. So now if you want to organise a protest or a rally, you have to ask for official permission first, and of course almost every single time official permission is refused. So you've got to either not protest, or you can protest illegally with a threat of significant fines. So the police really went out in force on Saturday. There are quite graphic and gruesome images of police beating up protesters, And this has come just basically straight after the Internet Governance Forum.
I'll admit, at times, I felt out of my depth in Baku. I spend most of my weeks surfing the web and looking for useful apps. To be thrust into the middle of this very real struggle for freedom and justice, where people stand to lose far more than just a couple of hours writing when their computer crashes, was a raw and vivid experience. An experience that touched me and made me want to help. But what can we do from the comfort and security of our neat little neighbourhoods? As it turns out, quite a lot.
I think there is plenty you can do. I think being active on the net also means that you need to be aware of the risks on the net, of course, if you're a human rights activist. Then there's in certain countries there are certain risks involved, of course, and this may not be so in our countries, of course, but in many other places. So to those who are in such places, one obvious thing is to raise awareness about the risks online. I think also secondly, to engage in these forums such as the IGF is important. There is a possibility to engage through civil society organizations, and they make up a large part of the IGF. And also the IGFs, they sort of go local. So in many countries there are national IGFs, which then becomes a country-wide meeting place to discuss all issues regarding internet.
Well, one thing you can do is pressure the companies in your country not to sell dual-use technology or at times single-use technology, which is really only being used to monitor and surveil. You can also pressure those companies to make public the requests for censorial action that they get. So, for example, the way that Google has its transparency report, you can encourage tech companies that are based in the UK to publish which governments are asking for what information, or you know, as much information as they can, make that transparent so that there's a way to take action.
I mean, one thing that listeners could do is they could, a couple of MPs have spoken out in favour of Azerbaijan at the Council of Europe, so listeners can write to Mike Hancock MP and write to the Liberal Democrat Party and say, you know, literally one sentence, write to the Liberal Democrat Party and say, why is Mike Hancock representing the Liberal Democrats at the Council of Europe? Normally the Liberal Democrats have a very good record in defending human rights at the Council of Europe. Mike Hancock has spoken at the last session, tried to downplay serious allegations of human rights violations. Write to them, say, why is this happening?
It's important that people speak out against these things, and they make their politicians to speak out against these things, and they hold their politicians all over the world accountable for sacrificing human rights agenda for sacrificing human rights agenda to geopolitical and economic interests. So this is very important to ask politicians why they are friendly with dictators.
One very practical thing you can do as an activist is to support other activists in repressive situations by, for example, using software that enables them to be anonymous on the net, and that kind of technique often means that people in other places need to be involved too. So that is one way that you practically can involve yourself.
One such program is the Tor project. It's been covered previously on the Pod Delusion, and I'll get James to add a link to the website. If you heard the original report and thought it wasn't relevant to you because you're not techie enough and you're not really doing any online activism, think again. This is something you can really do. It will cost you nothing other than a few minutes installing and setting it up. And you'll be a perfectly legal part of a network of people helping to hide and protect those like Khadija and Emin, so that they can keep doing their work on the front lines of freedom for all of us. This has been Kate Russell expressing herself freely for the Pod Delusion.
This special podcast was brought to you by the Pod Delusion. Do remember to tune in to the full episodes 163 and listen to our regular weekly show at poddelusion.co.uk. But for now, thanks for listening.